come a long way, my friend. Across oceans, deserts. Seen things few men have seen.
The Fuhrer still will believe.
The end is in sight.
There is a whisper throughout the land that the hour of our judgment is upon us.
What madness is this?
This is a curse from hell, brought upon us by the Black Witch.
You have been found guilty of consorting with the devil.
Wait!
Do it.
No!
I am Daemon of Blybrook.
Your name has become legend. You must deliver the witch to Severac, where you will destroy the witch's powers.
That the witch...
That is not what I say. I will take the girl, but if she is not what you say, she will not be yours to burn.
You're not like the others. Do you believe I'm a witch, Baymon?
Don't be deceived. She sees the weakness that lies in our hearts. And what she sees there, she will use against us.
You're not afraid of me. Are you?
These men are prepared for battle.
They have to get in line behind me.
She'll turn one man against another.
They must be punished.
Let's finish this.
We're gonna need more holy water.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike Tacriccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
I am doing great. How are you?
I am good, Mike. We're about to talk about one of those Hollywood projects that bounces around for years and years before finally being made. In fact, this one had an 11-year journey to the screen.
What?
And it was worth it, right? Wouldn't you say?
That seems like a strong stance to take on this movie.
Well, it began life as a spec script in the year 2000, and a lot of studios ended up actually bidding on it. MGM placed the winning bid, but they never did anything with it, so it ended up at Columbia, and then it ended up at Relativity. Relativity got Dominic Cena on board, who directed Nicolas Cage in Gone in 60 Seconds. He got attached to direct this movie, and in 2008, Nicolas Cage was cast in the lead role. Production began on a movie called Season of the Witch, as soon as Cage had wrapped filming on Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. Now, this is not to be confused with George Romero's Season of the Witch or Halloween 3 Season of the Witch. This is a different season and a different witch. It's an entirely different movie.
Not the first time Cage has started a movie that has a title similar to other movies that are unrelated to other movies. Bad Lieutenant.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's a good point.
You're welcome.
Yes. There was a stretch to get there, but I'm glad you pulled it off.
It was a long walk, but, you know.
Now, most of the first round of filming took place in practical locations all around the world. Austria, Hungary, and Croatia. But the movie needed to be reworked, especially in the battle sequences. So months after filming wrapped, the cast and crew went in for reshoots. But director Dominic Cena was no longer available, or maybe he was pushed out. So the reshoots were directed by none other than an uncredited Brett Ratner, Mike.
What?
Yeah. Who, of course, also directed Nicolas Cage in The Family Man. So there's another Cage director reunion right there, too. I think it is kind of interesting to look at what Cage was interested in doing around this time. You know, when Season of the Witch came out, I remember a lot of people writing it off as a movie Cage made just to make some money to settle his debts.
Right.
And while that's probably a factor, maybe even a major factor, don't forget, he had also just starred in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. So I think around 2009, Cage just got really into like mystical, fantastical stuff. And that was reflected in some of the movies he starred in around that time. We also got Drive Angry and Ghost Rider 2 coming out around the same time frame.
Yeah, I think it is real interesting that specifically, Sorcerer's Apprentice and Season of the Witch, I think it's an interesting back-to-back doubleheader Cage pairing of just these weird fantasy-ish stories that come out at the same time.
Yeah, well, they also both seem to be chasing, like, different fantasy tropes that were big at the time, right? I feel like Sorcerer's Apprentice is chasing that young adult Harry Potter kind of fantasy. Whereas this movie is kind of chasing after a little bit more of an epic Lord of the Rings style thing going on. I would say this dash of Tolkien in this movie. But an interesting side note is that according to Nicolas Cage, he saw the film as an homage to the B horror movies that he had grown up loving as a kid. Stuff like the Hammer Horror Pictures and Roger Corman Productions. You're nodding, so I'm guessing you got that vibe as well.
Yeah, a little bit. I was going to say that Season of the Witch has a bit more of that, like, dark edge to it than Lord of the Rings does.
Right. I don't think it has like the epic scope or something like Lord of the Rings has, but I feel like it has a lot of the same tropes, like in terms of its battle sequences and the way characters speak to each other. It feels Tolkien-esque in
yes,
a way to me.
I agree.
Okay, but anyway, Nicolas Cage did feel like this movie celebrated the works of actors he admired, like Vincent Price and Christopher Lee, and was incredibly excited when Christopher Lee himself actually ended up being cast in this movie. Supposedly, the movie also draws inspiration from Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal, but I think you'd have to stretch to find any meaningful connection between those two movies.
I mean, like, there's a plague, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, there's like, you know, death and stuff.
There's like, swords. There's knights.
True. I mean, like I said, I feel like it's a stretch. It's a stretch to say the least. But it is noted on the Wikipedia page and the IMDb page, so I figured I'd throw it out there. I'm sure like Dominic Cena said it in an interview once, like around the time the movie came out. Oh, it's kind of like Seventh Seal, and it's just stuck on the internet forever. I should also note, this movie was severely delayed at the last minute, Mike. It was meant to be released in March 2010, but just 5 weeks before it was supposed to come out, it got pushed to January 2011.
Wow.
It was the New Mutants of its day. It was a delay that close to release is usually a very bad sign. And getting pushed into a release date in the first weekend of January is an even worse one. But maybe Season of the Witch would turn out to be good, right?
I mean, maybe.
No, the answer's no. It's a big old nope for me. Season of the Witch currently holds a 9% on Rotten Tomatoes.
What?
Single digits, there it is, and got Nicolas Cage a Razzie nomination for Worst Actor. But since it was the only major release for the first 2 weeks in January, it managed to do okay at the box office, at least worldwide. On a budget of $40 million, it took in about $91 million. So, you know, there's that. So Nicolas Cage stars in this movie as Benin von Bleibrook, which may be the best name for any Cage character ever. I have to give it that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I agree.
You know, like I really liked like Balthazar Blake in Sorcerer's Apprentice. I thought that was a great name. But Benin von Bleibrook, there's so many B's in that name. I got to give it props. Got to give him a hand for that one. And Cage's right-hand man and best friend, Felsen, is played by Ron Mother Effin Perlman, Mike, who, of course, is known for Hellboy, Sons of Anarchy, and a whole bunch of stuff, usually with Guillermo del Toro. And from there, Robert Sheehan, known for his role on Misfits, plays Kayvon Wallenbach, a young kid who joins them on their quest. And then in her film debut, Claire Foy from The Crown plays Anna, the girl accused of being a witch. She was just recently in Steven Soderbergh's Unsane as well. And I gotta say, okay, so neither of us really like this movie, I don't think.
No.
I think Claire Foy is really good in it.
Like, yeah.
I think she's actually like having the most fun. Like, I think she was the most dynamic performance in this movie. So I want to give props to Claire Foy. I've not watched The Crown. I've heard it's really good. But I did like Unsane a lot. So there's that.
There you go.
Then you got Stephen Campbell Moore, known for his roles in The History Boys and The Bank Job with Jason Statham, playing De Belzac. Also, he was married to Claire Foy. I believe they met on the set of this movie. So, little historical fact for you there, Mike. And Ulrich Thompson, who was a henchman in The World Is Not Enough, the James Bond movie, plays Johann Eckhart.
Oh, yeah. I do remember him from World Is Not Enough.
There you go.
Look at that.
That, like, dawning recognition on your face. I love seeing it.
Yeah.
And then you've got Stephen Graham, who I was excited to see, because he played Al Capone in Boardwalk Empire. He plays Hagemar in this movie. The names of this movie are really my favorite part, I gotta say.
Oh, it's great. It's medieval, Eastern European, like, pseudo-Slavic names. Yeah, great.
Perfect.
Wonderful.
Perfect stuff. And then you've got the legendary Christopher Lee appearing in a couple of scenes as Cardinal D'Ambrose. Then Brian F. O'Byrne, a prolific actor who has appeared in Million Dollar Baby, The New World, and Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, plays the Grand Master of the Teutonic Knights. Finally, in the opening scene, Rory McCann plays the soldier commander in Villac. Now, you may not know the name Rory McCann. You may know him better as the Hound in Game of Thrones.
Okay. So there was a moment where I forget what words he says, but I was like, that was the Hound. Like, like, I don't think you even see his face when he says it.
Yeah.
He might be like, fuck off. And I was like, that's the Hound.
Yeah,
I can't remember what he says.
Yeah, for anybody who doesn't watch Game of Thrones, he was also the guy who says Yarp in Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, you're right.
Now, the film was written by Bragi F. Schutt, who today works as a writer on the LEGO TV series Ninjago Masters of Spinjitzu. So there's that.
Yeah, how about that?
And it was directed by Dominic Sena with uncredited reshoots by Brett Ratner, both directors Cage had worked with in the past. Now, Ratner has made a couple of movies in the decade since, although he's recently been outed for his sexual harassment, so I doubt he'll make many more. But part of the reason I think filming this was a disaster is that Dominic Sena has not done anything since this movie. Just straight up.
Wow.
His Wikipedia and IMDb page, they both stopped dead in their tracks in 2011. And he was a pretty prolific director for a long time. He did a lot of music videos in the 90s and 2000s. He directed Gone in 60 Seconds. He did Swordfish and stuff like that. Season of the Witch is the absolute last thing in his filmography. And he has not done anything since.
Now, I have to ask, is it because he's dead?
No, he's not dead.
Okay, all right. That changes it.
I would have I wouldn't have brought it up if he died.
I just want our listeners to have a clear picture, Mike.
Okay. No, Dominic Sena is very much alive. He's still listed as an active filmmaker on his Wikipedia page and his IMDb page and stuff like that. There's just been no credits to his name since 2011 when Season of the Witch came out. And I'm pretty sure it's because Season of the Witch was a disaster on every level. The IMDb plot synopsis for Season of the Witch reads, 14th century knights transport a suspected witch to a monastery where monks deduce her powers could be the source of the Black Plague. Now, Mike, we both just watched Season of the Witch last night. What are your overall thoughts on this movie?
Season of the Witch is somehow a movie that sets, like, with that premise, right? It sounds like it should be cool and right up my alley as someone that is a huge fan of Dungeons and Dragons and fantasy and
I knew you were
Conan.
Bring that up. I was looking at the Letterboxd Netflix reviews and like half of them were like, this would be a great D&D campaign.
It would. That's exactly the thought process I had. This would be amazing. A bunch of reluctant adventurers have to transport a witch, you know, across terrible terrain and through danger to these monks that can possibly save her and the whole realm. Like, yes, fucking give me that character sheet. Let's go. So it manages to take that premise and just like do nothing with it. I don't understand how there feels like there's no stakes whatsoever in this movie at all. Not at one second was I worried for any of these people, and not because it's so obvious that they're going to succeed or anything like that. Just I didn't care.
Right.
Like, I just there was no tension. There's no buy-in from me somehow. I was so disappointed.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this movie is kind of fun for about half a second when it seems like the movie will be focusing on badass medieval war buddies Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman. Right. So like when their characters are first introduced, these guys are two soldiers fighting in the Crusades and their dialogue is very anachronistic. Like they're just talking like modern people would be talking while everyone else is talking like, you know, like in ye old English or whatever. and like Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman are just like snarking back and forth and being like, oh, we're getting drinks in that at the bar, bud, and stuff like that. But I love that. Like I couple of minute sequence where it's just like Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman destroying entire armies by themselves and then going to get drunk at the bars and hanging out with girls. That was great. That should have been the movie.
Yeah.
That's your movie right there. But it's the most like as soon as that ends, it's the most like drab and boring take on the story. Like it occasionally flirts with something interesting, right? I feel like Cage's character on paper sounds like a really interesting character, but it just never engaged with any of that on any level. And then on top of that, I think it's just a very poorly made movie. You know, I think the visual effects are often laughably bad, especially towards the end. Mm-hmm. It's lit so dark. I don't know whether to blame the lighting crew or the cinematographer or whatever. You can barely see some of the stuff that goes on in this movie. And I was watching it on a relatively clear Blu-ray that Netflix had sent to me. You know, it looks very murky and grim, and, you know, that fits the story that it's telling, I guess. But it, you know, it doesn't look good, you know?
No. Yeah, somehow this movie does this weird thing, right, where Cage sort of like renounces his vows to the church, right? It's sort of like you know, as a crusader knight, right? Like
right.
He's sort of like the only one that doubts this mission and is like reluctant to. I think they get like arrested into doing it or something. I don't remember exactly
like
how they end up. Yeah, Cage is the only one who thinks that for a while, at least, that Anna, the woman, is not a witch. At least he starts that way, right? He says, "You're going to get a fair trial. Like, I'll protect you," and all this stuff. The problem with that, though, is that the prologue of the movie explicitly shows us that witches and demons and magic are real.
Right.
When the hanged woman comes out of the river and murders the priest. And then we see Anna doing evil shit.
Right.
So, like, that tension of, like, is she here? Like, is this in their minds? Like, you know, that, like, where you can go with that type of story where, like, there's only one person doubts that she's a witch kind of thing, and that
right.
conflict is just totally undermined by the movie itself because
yes.
we see her doing witchy shit. And
like, we know she's a witch. Yeah, I mean, I think even more than that, like, this movie tries to examine, like, how fucked up it is that, like, people would kill others because they perceive them to be witches, right? Even though
right.
they weren't, and why that's wrong. And that's completely undercut when you have these characters on this mission who are, like, accusing this woman of being a witch. And Cage is like, maybe she's not a witch, but she is a witch.
Yeah.
It's like that's what it, like, it completely baffles me that, like, you know, it seems like it's going in one direction. Like, oh, wow, like, they're going to... Like, maybe you have to prove that she's not a witch and that kind of thing, right? That seems like
right.
the way it's going to go. But she's a witch. She just is a witch. And
yeah.
so it completely, like you said, completely undermines everything the movie's going for the entire 90-minute runtime, which, thank God, this movie's only 90 minutes long.
Oh, oof. You know, every time I sit down for one of these movies, I'm real worried that it's going to be like a 210 or something like that. But it's always a pleasure when you start a movie and the progress bar pops up and it's like an hour and 30 minutes.
Right. Like, we know it'll be bad, but it'll be short at least.
At least that.
And it still felt a lot longer than 90 minutes. I mean, I started this movie at about 4 o'clock, fell asleep 20 minutes in. So I had to pause it and like rewind and stuff like that. And then I had to after like a half hour, I had to stop again, like, to do, like, I basically watched this movie in like 20 to 30 minute chunks.
Oh so. Man, that must've felt like a lifetime.
It really did, man. It took me like probably twice as long as the movie actually is to actually finish it. But at the same time, I'm grateful that I took those breaks for myself, like,
yeah.
that I didn't just watch this all in one sitting. So it kind of just felt like I was staring at a dark screen for 90 minutes. Like, I barely retained anything that was going on in the movie. So this might be a pretty short episode because I don't remember a lot of the movie and I watched
That's
it yesterday. But this movie really feels to me like the movie that will define most of Cage's films in the 2010s. This is I remember seeing ads for this movie, and even then, even as a big fan of Nicolas Cage, as a big fan of Ron Perlman, being like, no. Like, this didn't look good. And I think we're going to be wading through a lot of crap from this point forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it all starts with Season of the Witch. Like, this is the defining film of the 2010s for me. Is that, like, okay, well, we're going to sit through a lot of lousy stuff. And I think Season of the Witch is what kicks that off from this point forward.
Yeah, it was interesting that you said that this movie has the reputation for being the, like, Cage needed to get a check to pay off his debts thing, because that's basically how I picture his career for the next 18 years. When did this movie come out? 2011, I guess?
2011, so the next 10
years. 17 years?
Yeah,
till now?
It's been eight years, man. What are you talking about?
Jesus Christ.
It's been 7 years. It's been 7 years.
That's how long this movie felt like.
You added 10 years
to your
life.
I'm an old man now.
Yeah,
I'm recording from the future.
I didn't want to comment on the long white beard that you had when we started up the Skype call, but
You know, thanks for thinking of me.
Well, what did you think of Nicolas Cage in this movie, Mike? His role as Bemin von Bleibrook. How did you think he fit into this movie?
I think it's interesting that you said that they had to come back for reshoots like months and months later.
Yeah.
Because there are definitely scenes where you're like, this is a totally different accent and cadence that you're using to talk in than what you were just using.
Not only that, but I feel like you can tell what scenes are green screen and which ones aren't.
Oh, well, that was obvious.
Because I actually didn't mention this in the top, but all the reshoots were done on green screen. Whereas the principal photography was done on location. And you can tell the difference, like, pretty clearly.
Yeah. Yeah, I do love that there's the one moment real early on in that montage sequence, like, the Crusades, where, like, it's the first big battle or whatever, and they're, like, standing on the hill at crest of a sand dune, and this guy's proselytizing about killing the whatever.
Right.
And it's very clearly, like, six dudes in front of a green screen looking out at nothing.
Right.
That was a good way to start your movie 4 minutes in.
Quality stuff.
Quality. But yeah, as far as Cage goes, I think it sort of isn't like the worst performance. It's just not good. I don't know. I don't know how to put it. It sort of fit the movie, which is not a great thing to say,
right?
I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think Cage is kind of fun when he gets to have that anachronistic wartime dialogue with Ron Perlman. They have a very good dynamic going on, and I wish they were in a better movie together, right? Like, can you imagine a great, like, awesome action movie with Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman, right? Like, it doesn't have to be this movie, you know?
No.
You know what I mean?
Like, we could have had something better.
Those two should be in a better movie together. But again, Cage's arc is potentially a really interesting one. He's a guy who fights in the Crusades, believes in God, but becomes disillusioned with the fighting and the man-made church, but still wants to serve God in some other way. Like, there's a good story buried in there somewhere. Like, I think that's a really fascinating character to look at.
Damon is a... I like to think of him as a radical thinker for these times, a real iconoclast and an adventurous, almost, I guess you could say, intellectual warrior priest in some regards. He's a man who joined the Crusades believing he was doing the right thing and just got sick of the killing. He got sick of it. And there was a profound moment that occurs where a young Turkish girl is slain by his sword, and it is this awakening, this epiphany that he feels used, he feels that he's not doing what God wants him to do, and really goes AWOL and decides to separate from the church.
For the most part, though, yeah, I think Cage is just serviceable in this movie, I feel like. You know, he's kind of, I'm not going to say he's sleepwalking through the role, but I feel like the character is written as if he's sleepwalking through the room.
Yeah, I mean, that disillusions type of character is that way, right? Like, stony, doesn't believe in the mission he's on kind of thing.
Right.
So, like, it makes sense that there's not much there in his performance, I guess, in some weird way.
Yeah, but of the two of them, like, Ron Perlman is the one who I think pops out a lot more in this movie. But that's because his character is written as a lot more fun. You know, he gets to have all the he's this joke, and he gets to be like the center of the two of them, and he's like, he doesn't care, he just weighs in it for the money and that kind of thing. Like, it made sense to me. Like, Ron Perlman is a lot of fun in this movie, but again, he's not nearly enough of the focus to make this movie worth recommending to people.
Yeah, it felt a lot like you know, to talk about the way this movie connected to other Ron Perlman roles. No. Whatever your question you ask me is.
And now we're segueing into Perlmancast.
But like in Drive, his character in Drive is just like a totally different movie that he's in. And he's like doing his own goofy Ron Perlman thing. And he's doing it in this too. And it's a lot of fun. It's a great foil to Cage's just like existing.
Right. Yes, definitely. Now, how do you think this role fits into the roles that we've seen Nicolas Cage play so far rather than Ron Perlman? Like, since you're bringing up other films.
Well, it definitely like the obvious connection to Sorcerer's Apprentice, right? Just the
magical goofy elements.
Yeah, the magical goofy fantasy stuff. But other than that, nothing really stood out to me, because it just sort of feels like we're at the precipice again, and here we go with the bad movies.
Well, I will say, yeah, it has the magical elements of Sorcerer's Apprentice. I also feel like it has the demonic elements of Ghost Rider at play.
I
feel like Season of the Witch is a mix of Sorcerer's Apprentice and Ghost Rider, but much worse than either of those two movies.
Somehow.
Yeah. Well, because I kind of like both of those two movies. Somewhat pro. I don't think either one's great, but I think I'm somewhat pro Ghost Rider and Sorcerer's Apprentice. And I'm not pro Season of the Witch, I gotta say. Because that's the thing. I feel like, you know, Season of the Witch is such a boring movie, too, and that's the thing. It's not like... like, with a lot of Cage's bad movies, some of them are entertainingly bad, you know, like...
Right.
Or at least, like, bad in a way where I am so... I feel something, right? Like, I mm-hmm. feel frustrated or I feel annoyed or whatever. And Season of the Witch, I felt nothing. You know, I felt
you're just
nothing.
Dead on the inside. I just... Tell my wife I said hello.
Exactly. You know, like with something like Next, right? Next was a terrible movie. It's one of the worst movies we've reviewed in this podcast.
Yeah.
But I was so... bewildered by Next.
You know? You were transfixed.
I was transfixed by my confusion about how anybody could make that movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes.
Where Season of the Witch feels like everyone did an okay to mediocre job in service of a story that just wasn't there. I feel like it might be the most mediocre movie we've talked about on this entire podcast. Like I have a running ranked list of all the Cage movies we've watched on my Letterboxd account, and I put this movie dead last for a minute just to see how it felt. It felt pretty good. Like
that's where, yeah, yeah.
So it may have unseated Captain Corelli's Mandolin, my least favorite movie that we reviewed in this podcast. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how I feel in a few weeks. But were there any moments or scenes in this movie that stood out to you, Mike? So I mean, we've talked about how boring this movie is. So was there anything that like actually kind of caught your interest?
I don't know about. If it's one particular scene, but I do want to bring up the, I guess, it, you know, it makes sense in regards to Cage talking about, or whoever that quote was, that like it sort of is an homage to like the Hammer films and like those B horror stuff.
Right.
Some of the like practical gore or disfigurement effects are like really intense and cool. Like Christopher Lee with the plague shit on his face.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like it's really like it. Those kind of things did remind me of those like early zombie movies, and it's like I don't know, they're doing a lot of weird makeup, and it's not just some gross CGI blob,
right?
You know, there are a lot of dead zombie guys kind of in this, like particularly the monks at the end. But yeah, I don't know, that like just that in general, I sort of gave this movie a little bit of credit when they were using like practical makeup to make people look like that.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I agree with that. I mean, Christopher Lee's boils are very distinctive for sure. Like just all over his face. Yeah. And it helps that they have Christopher Lee playing that role because he can act through those prosthetics and stuff like that. But also, it's a great it's a nice homage to his role in the Hammer horror films. Like he was iconic for playing Dracula in those movies and stuff like that. So very cool. I think got Christopher Lee for that. I think it's two scenes that he's in.
Yeah, it's a few minutes total.
Yeah, he's maybe in 3 minutes of this movie. But, you know, I think, and like I said before, I think Claire Foy is actually really great in this movie. She's easily the best performance going on. I think she plays up the campiness of her role very well.
Yes.
So when she does start to go crazy, do insane witch shit, you know, it's a lot of fun to watch her at least. But then she kind of turns into a CGI demon at the end.
Kinda?
Okay, she turns into a CGI demon at the end. And the CGI demon looks real bad. Like it does not look good. It looks like my immediate thought was that it looked like the CGI evil Scrappy Doo from the live action Scooby Doo movie.
Holy shit! Yes,
which is not the look you want for like a terrifying demon character. You know what I mean?
No, that you've been building up to for the last hour and 20 minutes.
Exactly. But I mean that whole sequence in the castle and stuff when the demon's attacking them. Like there's you know some fun action beats, I guess. You know, Perlman and Cage both die in the end. And Kay and Anna ride off into the sunset together once she's cured of her witchiness or whatever. But I thought Perlman's death was kind of funny when he just gets like engulfed in flames, CGI flames, and he like dissolves. There's actually one beat that really made me laugh I think it's Kay who gets knocked down, or the priest, or whoever the priest is, Dezelbach or whatever, who gets like knocked down by a demon or whatever, and they just like narrowly escape their lives. And he like looks to Cage and is like, "We're going to need more holy water."
Oh, yeah.
It's like his Chief Brody moment in Jaws. And it's like, yeah, okay. All right.
All right. Sure.
I will say, when they start explaining the quest to Cage at the beginning, I started thinking to myself as they were explaining what he had to do. And I was like, an adventurer abandons his people and ends up in a medieval city and is sent on a quest to retrieve an ancient spellbook that results in a winged demon attacking them. But enough about Army of Darkness, Mike. That's the movie that I wish I was watching.
That's actually really funny you bring that up. I didn't make that connection, but it's such a weird thing. Now that you said that they thought it was an homage to those B horror movies, I can't move past it because none of them are playing. There's no camp involved other than in Anna's character, like, or the character of Anna, the witch. So like, it's so weird that they thought they were doing that. And also, I mean, I think you're right that somebody probably in one of those 12-hour press days made a comment about Seventh Seal. But to make a movie that is both an homage to B Hammer movies and Seventh Seal, weird take.
Yeah, bold move. The fact that people, like, there's both of those things are on this IMDb page makes me feel like nobody involved in the movie actually had a firm idea of what they were doing.
No. Nobody knew what was going on.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the only other scene I can think of that, like, stands out to me is the bridge crossing scene.
Yes.
Where Cage just says, fuck it, and crosses the bridge on his own. He's like, I got this. And they go across the bridge, and then there's a whole, like, oh, will a bridge fall? Will it not fall? And of course it falls, and they have to get it up, like, over the bridge in time. And, like, it's, like, relatively exciting, maybe? Like,
I feel like the movie wants it to be so exciting.
Right.
Because we take a long time to go through that scene, that whole process.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, nothing really happens.
No, it's so...
It's the cliche. Like, it would have been better if it took to like a 30 seconds, and then we just make it across. Like, that would have been hilarious.
Exactly.
But nope, we do what everyone expected, and it's a whole big thing, and the bridge collapses. I'm like, all right, cool.
Yeah. I don't know. I really don't have that much else, to be quite honest. What did you think of the ensemble, like, as a whole? Like, I guess we talked about Cage and Perlman and Claire Foy separately, but, like, those three together, the other members of their group, Stephen Campbell Moore, Stephen Graham.
I thought it was sort of interesting. Like, I think it was partly my, like, affinity for D&D and, like, pulp fantasy stuff that made me be on, maybe be down for this, like, road movie, right, where, like, the second act, I guess, where we're just after they accept the mission and they form their group and they go out on the road, and then, like, the young kid shows up and he's clearly in over his head, and, like, what are they gonna do? Oh my god, all this crazy stuff,
right?
And I was, like, sort of down for that, like, where it's just these kind of, like, grizzled adventurers with a priest there, like, all that, like, that weird inter-party stuff.
Yeah.
All those things. So, like, I was sort of down for, like, maybe 20 minutes, and then it just really outstayed its welcome, and, like, nothing exciting happened yet.
Right.
Although, I guess there is the scene when Anna tricks or manages to kill Eckhart, right, or whatever, like, when he mentions his daughter and all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, well, that was so weird, because she stabbed him with the key or whatever, right, before, like, she escapes the... She, like, escapes the cage, right? And she stabs him with the key, and he gets like, stabbed. And I was like, oh, man, Eckhart's dying. And then he's alive. And then, like, 5 minutes later, she stabs him again. and then he dies.
Yeah, I mean, that whole sequence didn't really make sense, because, right, she I think it's the priest that she grabs this key off of.
Something like, yeah.
Somebody. But she says, like, give me that key, rips it off his neck, and stabs it through his hand so he's, like, pinned to the cart.
Yeah.
But somehow is also unlocks the door and gets out. Right. Like, in the same moment?
Right.
Yeah, and then I thought that was kind of interesting, like, a cool witchy power where she makes Eckhart see his daughter, so he runs into the sword of the other guy.
Right.
Like, by accident, you know, kind of weird, like, Final Destination shit.
Yeah.
But I was sort of into it for that moment. But, like, again, we kind of don't really go anywhere with it, and that confirms that she's a witch, so Cage's, like, supposed turmoil over whether or not she is one is just ruined.
Right.
So that became boring. And then most of the rest of the movie was boring.
Yeah. I gotta say, I will say I was kind of into the prologue scene that took place, like, 100 years before the events of this actual movie, where it's, like, a witch hanging. It was, like, surprisingly brutal. Like, they don't really show, like, the actual snapping of the neck or anything, I don't think. But, like, they have these three girls who they are accusing of being a witch. And they end up, you know, throwing them all over a bridge, and they're hanged and then drowned. And it's, like, it's like the sound effects are intense and, like, gross. And, like, it's a very brutal sequence. So I was kind of into that. Like, I felt like it was That felt to me like it was diving into the horror aspect of it pretty well. Yeah. Plus, it had the Hound from Game of Thrones, and that was pretty cool too. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't expecting that stuff. I didn't know a ton about Season of the Witch before we saw it. So like when it opens with those kind of like really like in weird camera angles, I'm pretty sure like it's really close up of the priest's face and stuff and like weird stuff going on. Where I was like, oh man, we're gonna do some like horror, medieval horror shit. All right, cool.
Yeah.
And then we don't really.
No, and then it cuts ahead. Then it cuts ahead like 80 years. You see Cage and Perlman fighting in the Crusades, and that's done over like a montage of like 12 years or something like that. And then the movie actually starts. But either the prologue stuff would have been more interesting to follow, or them fighting in the Crusades would have been more interesting to follow. Like this movie peaks like 5 minutes in, and then it just it's downhill from there.
I might just watch Kingdom of Heaven as a palate cleanser.
The director's cut, I hope.
The draw, of course.
How could you not? So I think I genuinely don't have that much else to say about this movie.
No,
I'm struggling with stuff. There's one scene that reminded me of The Grey where they're fighting wolves in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, and The Grey came out a year later.
Even that had like a goofy, campy thing from what's her name, Claire Foy?
Claire Foy, yeah,
Claire Foy, right? Where she like is in the cart, in the wagon with the like the cover down or whatever, like covered so you can't see her, and she like howls like a wolf,
right?
And Cage like flips it up and she's like, oh, did you hear that? It's like so dumb and goofy. So campy, but that's really there's not enough of that to balance out
how dreary and dull this movie is.
Yes,
and I think that about wraps up our thoughts on Season of the Witch. It's a relatively short episode this time around, but we gotta talk about some Netflix and Letterboxd reviews. Mike, let's see what the other people had to say. I'll tell you this, there's a lot of one-star reviews.
Shocked, I tell you.
Yeah, I think these are all Letterboxd reviews, actually. For Season of the Witch, we're going to kick it off with a two-star review. And it goes like this. I got to give this one a low score because it's technically not very good. But I'll go ahead and put a little heart next to it because I loved seeing Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman playing badass knight dudes fighting demons and shit.
Yeah, give in the new D&D movie, cast them, please.
Right, that's all I need. That's all I need for that movie. Here's a one-star review of Season of the Witch. My journey to complete Nicolas Cage's filmography is going to take me to some terrible places. Buddy, we've been there. Three notes on this. One, it was terrible. Two, I slept through some of it. Three, I thought this was the film he did with Hayden Christensen until about 20 minutes in.
What? Oh my god, that's amazing.
Yeah, did you not know that he did a movie with Hayden Christensen?
No, what?
Oh man, yeah, we're gonna get to that at some point. That's
what have you signed me up for, Mike? I thought we were friends, but maybe not.
This is a long con. This entire podcast was just a long con to trick you into watching a Hayden Christensen movie.
Son of a bitch.
Here's another one-star review of Season of the Witch. Given his glazed expression and barely functioning interest level, I can only assume that Nick Cage now owns quite a nice yacht that this movie bought him. There's no other explanation for why he's here. Congrats to Claire Foy for meeting her future husband, though.
Yeah, look at that.
Yeah, there you go. Here's another one-star review of Season of the Witch. To quote Blackadder, it started badly. It tailed off a little in the middle, and the less said about the end, the better. But apart from that, it was excellent. Here's another one-star review, Season of the Witch. You know how in most period pieces, no matter where on Earth they take place, everyone speaks with a British accent to class up the joint? The producer of Season of the Witch couldn't even be bothered to do that.
You know, I did notice that.
Did you?
Yes.
That came to mind? Quite the opposite. Much of the supporting cast is filled with enjoyable British, Irish, and Danish actors from television forced to speak with American accents. Robert Sheehan, Ulrich Thompson, and Stephen Graham. Why? Because Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman didn't want to be bothered? Whatever. It's indicative of how little anyone cares in this lazy and cheap flick. Even noted auteur Dominic Cena... couldn't be bothered to finish shooting. Brett Ratner had to come in for reshoots. That speaks volumes.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, and finally I have one more, Mike. This is a one-star review of Season of the Witch, and I think it pretty much encapsulates everything I wanted to say about this movie. This review may contain spoilers. It's got 99 problems, but a witch ain't one.
Jesus Christ. I hate you so
much. There it is. There it is. So yeah, Season of the Witch. Bad movie. Bad time.
Yep.
You know, unenjoyable. 9%. Unenjoyable on just about every level.
Yeah.
You know, other than, you know, the brief glimpses you get of Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman fighting demons and being badasses and shit, it just is not a good time all around. So that's unfortunate. But we made it through, Mike. That's the important thing. This is one of the movies I was dreading the most, and now we finally passed it. So
yeah,
there's that.
We're stronger for it.
Exactly. We're better people because of it. Now, where can we find you online this week, Mike?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
And you can find me at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter, plus our podcast and stuff at filmbook.com. And follow me on Instagram. Why not? Radio Mike Sandwich. Go do that there. Thank you for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review, support this podcast, and Film Book, take part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. Now, any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast email about the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us in 2 weeks for another episode of The Complete Works, where we're talking about a movie that I liked a lot more. I haven't seen it since it was in theaters, but I loved it back then. We're talking 2011's Drive Angry, Mike.
Oh, God.
I was a big fan of this movie when it came out. Granted, I was 16 at the time, but I think that opinion should still be valid. We'll see. We'll see what
we'll
happens.
We'll find out.
I hope so. Unfortunately, we'll have to watch it in 2D. This movie was released in 3D originally, and the 3D was amazing. Drive Angry. Plus, you can keep an eye out for Film Bookcast, where I think we're talking Hereditary next week. Very much looking forward to that. I've heard nothing but great things about that horror movie, so that's going to be pretty insane. So, thanks so much for listening, guys, and thanks for getting in the cage.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Boom! Nick Cage, motherfucker! Nick Cage, motherfucker! Boom! Nick Cage, motherfucker! Think about that while you're leaving Las Vegas!